Well, thanks for getting back promptly after lunch so we can get started again. I usually need Bella to announce that the meeting's ready to start, and then it gets started.
We're starting the meeting. Jeff?
Well, I hope our next topic can generate as much enthusiasm and excitement as our last couple of discussions. The next topic we have on the agenda is this discussion of the auditing standards pertaining to subsequent events. We added the topic of subsequent events as a possible standard-setting item in response to when FASB put a project on their agenda for subsequent events. Historically, most of the literature around subsequent events resided in the auditing literature, and in May of 2009, FASB issued FAS 165. I don't know the new code, Tom, do you?
No, and I never will.
FASB issued a standard which requires public companies now to evaluate subsequent events as of each reporting period and through the date the financial statements are issued. After FASB issued that, we didn't feel it was necessary to issue any changes in our standard in response to the FASB standard on subsequent events. However, as part of our review of the standard and getting up to that point, we did take a look at it and think that there was possibilities for improvement in the standard for auditing subsequent events. And so we've kept it on our agenda. And what we wanted to do today was to talk about the subsequent events standard and get some input from the SAG members as to whether or not you thought this was an area where we should improve standards and could standards be improved, or do you think this is an area that we should drop to the a lower end of our priorities. But I'm sure each of you or many of you are aware of instances where investors have been surprised by developments that occurred shortly after a set of financial statements was released, either significant losses being recorded in the next quarter or even in some cases companies filing for bankruptcy shortly after the financial statements were filed. And I guess the question is, you know, could or should audit procedures intended to identify material events between the balance sheet date and the date the report was issued have identified such events in some of those instances? And are the existing auditing requirements pertaining to subsequent events robust enough to identify important material subsequent events? So we'll turn the discussion over to Barbara Vanich to lead this and then look for your input. Thank you.
Thank you, Marty. AU Section 560 is the board's existing standard that establishes audit requirements regarding subsequent events. It defines subsequent events as events or transactions that occur subsequent to the balance sheet date but prior to the issuance of the financial statements, which have a material effect on those financial statements and therefore require either adjustment to or disclosure in the financial statements. The first discussion topic for this afternoon has to do with the current audit requirements for identifying subsequent events. AU Section 560, which is included as an appendix to the briefing paper, requires that certain audit procedures be performed by the auditor after the balance sheet for the purpose of ascertaining the occurrence of subsequent events that may require adjustment or disclosure. These procedures include, for example, reading the latest interim financial statements and comparing them to the financial statements being reported on, reading minutes of meetings, making inquiries regarding any substantial contingent liabilities or commitments or changes in the capital stock, long-term debt, or working capital from the balance sheet date through the date of the auditor's inquiry, and also obtaining written representations of officers, executives, and clients' legal counsel. Given the potential importance of subsequent events to users of the financial statements, today we're looking for your view on whether these existing procedures might be supplemented with additional requirements or revised. For example, as I mentioned, the standard requires the auditor to inquire of and discuss with officers and other executives having responsibility for the financial and accounting matters as to whether any unusual adjustments were made during the subsequent period. AU Section 560 could be modified to explicitly require the auditor to perform tests on non-standard journal entries in the subsequent period to identify subsequent events. Another example might be to require the auditor to perform analytical procedures on accounts identified as significant risks relating to the latest available interim financial statements instead of the current requirement to read and compare the most interim financials to the financials being reported on. This brings us to our first discussion topic. Should any of the existing audit procedures for identifying subsequent events be strengthened? Should the standard require any additional audit procedures? And if so, what would they be? Galen Hansen?
Let me just share a few of my thoughts on this. Yes, I do think, and in fact, a number of these things I have always done, I was taught to always do, and I thought it was part of the standards. And so this was sort of refreshing for me to go through this to really realize what is required and what I think I probably have been doing on an optional basis for a long time. But tests of non-standard journal entries, I think it should be required, the analytical procedures. We do final analytical procedures, so I'm not sure where the crossover with that is. Also, another thing to think about is whether to require a review of subsequent financial statements. I think most people are already doing that, but that could be added to the list. And key performance indicators. Going down my list here, substantiating information in the subsequent events footnote. Actually, you know, what is required in that footnote? What do we mean by audit any of the information that is included there? Looking at significant subsequent transactions, not just the journal entries. Again, over the years, I've always looked at subsequent cash disbursements, significant subsequent receipts of cash, but that could even be extended to stock transactions. So those are some of the types of things that I think could be beefed up in that standard. I think there probably should be a requirement to discuss this in your exit or in the wrap-up with the audit committee chair in terms of significant items that floated to the top. So that could be considered. I think also specifically with respect to fraud, and I think this comes up in the Repo 105 type of situations, do we have sort of a reminder that that's something that we need to make sure that we've considered. And that's kind of my hit list.
So you're saying in the last one there, sort of update your where you think there are fraud risks in the company, update your considerations of
yes.
those fraud risks?
Yes.
Thanks, Gail.
Paul Sobel.
Thank you. A fairly quick comment. AU 560, while I know it's intended to be more broad, almost gives the implication that aside from general counsel, the primary focus of inquiry will be with accounting and financial folks. And I know that's not the intention, but that may be the way it's interpreted. My experience is that, particularly post Sarbanes-Oxley, disclosure committees, I think, do a very good job of trying to vet subsequent event information through the disclosure committee, and that it would probably be useful guidance. I don't know about a requirement, but useful guidance to the audit firms to make sure that they understand what that disclosure committee process is, and certainly consider interviewing some members of management who are not necessarily directly involved in accounting but may still be aware of events or transactions that may be bubbling up that should be considered.
Thank you, Arch.
When I first looked at this, I guess perhaps I had the same thought that Galen had, and that's what's the practice issue here. We've been dealing with subsequent events literature for a long time. One thing, by the way, I think that probably needs to come out of this standard is the accounting that's in it now and shouldn't be there any longer with 855. But in light of the things that, that Galen said, I think a lot of those things are in fact being done because the underlying principles of all of that are currently in the standard. And you might say, well, we could use some additional guidance and additional thoughts on things to consider, but I'd hesitate to get into a long list of rules because it's that seems to me to be taken completely away from a risk assessment process that should exist even in connection with the subsequent events. So I'd be cautious in that area.
Thank you. Doug Anderson?
Actually, I'll leverage just a little off of those last comments. When I read the standard again, it's been a while since I'd read it, it looks pretty old-fashioned is how I think of it. And what is it missing? One is it's missing a primary focus on risk, right? The auditor should be focusing on those areas that have the highest risk of identifying a Type 1 subsequent event. And it doesn't say that. In fact, the intro to paragraph 12 basically says the auditor generally should do these things. And it would imply, regardless of risk, what you're doing, we expect you to do these five things. And in my experience, the one in that list is probably the most useful is 12F, which says other things you think necessary. Right? And so I would rewrite it basically saying do the risk assessment, analyze those areas where you have the highest possibility of a type 1 subsequent event you want to deal with, or type 2 for disclosure, focus there, and then do those. On some of the specific areas, I would echo Paul. I don't think the focus should be on accounting and finance people. It should be on the inquiry should be with people that have responsibility for the economic events or the issues that could drive accounting as of the end of the year. I think we shouldn't be analyzing just interim financial statements. You should be looking at data and KPIs because a lot of this work will be done before interim financials are issued and published. So look at data. And then reviewing minutes is nice, but my experience is most corporations' minutes don't say a whole lot. And so I would look at more internal communications. Again, all within the umbrella, targeted to those specific areas where there's risk that you might have a material event that you missed a Type 1 subsequent event.
Thank you very much. John White.
I didn't go back and look at AS5 again on this point, but it seemed to me that one of the logical safeguards here would be that when you were looking at ICFR, that you would make sure that you had procedures in place. I mean, I realize it's done as of the end of the year, but that you should have robust ICFR procedures in place at the company that looked for subsequent events, and that obviously could also take you all the way up to the to the actual issuance date. That wouldn't be cutting off at the report date. But I mean, I don't know whether there's something needed additional to get to that result, but that seemed to me to be a way that it's putting the burden back on the company, but you'd be auditing for that at the time you did your ICFR audit.
Yeah, I'll comment on that because in looking at the analogous standard of the IAASB, which was written much more currently than the auditing standard on subsequent events that we have, there is a requirement to obtain an understanding of the procedures management has to identify subsequent events, and I think that's your point, that's what are the internal controls that management has to identify subsequent events that need to be accounted for or disclosed. And it sounds like something that could be in our standards.
I would have thought so. I mean, yeah. I thought that's a very effective way of, in effect, putting it back on the management.
Right.
And as I say, get you to the issuance date, to the extent that you're dealing with any gap there.
Right. One additional thing that's in the applicable ISA, and I think it's a tone thing, but I think maybe it does make a difference, is it says the auditor shall perform procedures designed to obtain sufficient appropriate audit evidence that all events occurring between the date of the financial statements and the date of the audit report that require adjustment over disclosure in the financial statements have been identified. So it's more of a statement that the auditor has to design procedures to identify events that need to be disclosed, whereas our existing standard to me seems to be more of a do certain things, and if they come to your attention, ensure it's reported. So I think there's a different tone in our current standard compared to what this objective is here. Does it sound that way to you also? Owen, you have a card up.
Yeah. I agree with the risk-based approach, and certainly the objectives, I think, are more important than just a listing of procedures. And in terms of looking at the controls, I think the part of the controls you look at on the AS5 are the financial statement close process. So even though we're opining with controls as of a certain date, part of the financial statement controls process evaluation is, you know, what happens after the end of the year with respect to the subsequent events evaluation.
Galen?
You know, Marty, this does remind me a little bit of the conversation that we've had about the going concern, and it strikes me as being a subsequent events footnote. It's part of the financial statements, and maybe I could ask Tom. I mean, is the FASB looking at it updating any of that standard with respect to the accounting or the disclosure requirements? I don't mean to put you on the spot here. But.
No, we issued Statement 165
right.
That brought into the literature subsequent disclosure requirements and
okay.
made it part of the U.S. GAAP.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. With that, we'll move on to our next discussion topic. This relates to the auditor's responsibility for identifying subsequent events in the period after the date of the auditor's report through the issuance of the financial statements. AU Section 560 provides that for purposes of the audit, the period with which the auditor must be concerned is considered to extend from the date of the financial statements to the date of the auditor's report. AU Section 530 states that the auditor dates the audit report no earlier than the date on which the auditor has obtained sufficient competent evidence to support the auditor's opinion. However, AU Section 530 also states that the auditor then has no responsibility to make any inquiry or carry out any auditing procedures for the period after the date of his report. In the staff's view, and at least in practice for larger U.S. companies, we believe that audit report dates are now often dated very close to the date that the financial statements are issued, and therefore the time period not covered by subsequent event procedures may be relatively limited. However, IFRS has a different requirement in that companies preparing financial statements under IFRS consider subsequent events through the date the financial statements are authorized to be issued. This date can occur sometime before the issuance of the financial statements and could result in a longer period correspondingly not being covered by the auditor's subsequent events review. Now, it's important to note that when an auditor's report is going to be included in a registration statement filed with the SEC, additional subsequent events are procedures after the date of the audit report. For example, when financial statements are included or incorporated by reference in a registration statement, the auditor performs subsequent event procedures similar to those in AU Section 560 up to the effective date of the filing or as close as is reasonably practicable in the circumstances. However, keeping in mind that not all financial statements are currently included in or incorporated by reference in a registration statement, our next topic for discussion has to do with whether or not, in your view, the auditor should be required to perform additional procedures similar to those in AU Section 560 to identify and evaluate subsequent events through the date of issuance of the auditor's report, or could any procedures during this period be limited to at least inquiries regarding material adverse effects? John White?
I guess my first reaction is it's not clear to me why there should be a different standard between the two time periods. I looked also at what large U.S. companies do, and at least a quick survey suggested that I looked at the 25 of the Dow 30 companies that had reported so far this year. And I think 22 of the 25, the two reports, the report and the issuance date were exactly the same. and the other three were one day, and seven business days difference. So, I mean, for at least for larger companies, it's the same date already. But let's assume that it isn't the same date. I guess I don't quite see why you wouldn't have the same standard. I mean, you do it if you have, if you've got a, if you're doing a registration statement, or if you've got a shelf in place and you've got a consent as part of the 10K, then you've got to bring it down to the date of the filing of the 10K in the same sort of way. I just didn't see why there is a difference.
Yeah, there's a difference in the existing standards.
No, but I mean, I didn't see why there should be.
Why there should be, right. Yeah, that's sort of why we're bringing the point up here that, as you suggest, when you're doing a filing under the 33 Act, you have to bring the subsequent events right up to the date of the filing, whereas under the 34 Act, effectively, if the report date is 2 weeks before, current standards say you don't have to do anything between the report date and the date of the filing.
I mean, maybe somebody from one of the accounting firms can enlighten us of why there is no gap. I was assuming on the large companies there's no gap because most of them have shelves in place. And so you've got to do consents anyway, and so you couldn't afford to have a gap. But, I mean, you'd have to – but I don't know why – is there a reason why it's kind of gotten to be no gaps?
Yeah, gaps on between the filing date and the audit report date?
Yeah, yes.
That was the result of 165.
Yeah.
I mean,
the company must evaluate subsequent events through the filing of the financial statements, and therefore our audit procedures and our audit report will cover the same period.
I'm sorry, then what are the two different discussions we are having here then?
Well, there's not a... I guess what Kevin is saying is that practice has changed as a result of 165, that since companies have to evaluate subsequent events up through the date they file their report, auditors are effectively doing that as well and dating their audit report essentially about the date of issuance or very close to the date of issuance, as your brief survey showed. Right. So I guess the question that we're posing here is maybe this is a standard whose time has passed or needs to be changed. Lynn, you had your card up?
Yeah, Marty, I actually have a question for you and the staff. Obviously, the board has a lot of important projects on its agenda, and it's looking at taking this one up. That would tend to tell me that the board has seen problems in its inspections. I mean, there must be some reason you're taking up the subsequent events now. So my really twofold, why are you doing it now in light of some of the other priorities on the agenda? And two, are there problems that you're seeing? And if so, what specifically are the problems you're seeing in auditing practice in this area? Because that would help me respond to the questions then.
I touched on this maybe before you stepped back. It was added to our agenda because FASB had put subsequent events on its agenda, and so we wanted to see if we needed to do something in response to that. So that's why it was initially put on. We're considering whether to keep it on as part of this discussion we're having today. But I think I did point out that, over the past couple of years, I think a number of investors have been surprised after financial statements have been filed that in the next quarter companies took large losses and or in some cases went into bankruptcy. And the question arises, should or could subsequent event procedures between the financial statement date and the report date potentially have identified the deterioration that took place, and therefore are the subsequent event procedures in our standards robust enough?
Right. If I could add, Lynn, I think that there, in the triennial firm 4010, there are some instances where firms were written up because they did not comply with the existing standard, but there would be no findings related to facts places where the firms had not done enough, but they had done enough to be in accordance with the standard. So I think it gets to what Marty said is, if the standard were more robust, we might have more findings in this area.
I think that's the point. And I think we're hearing from Galen and others that In fact, their practices that they're performing are in excess of what the current standard would seem to require. And the applicable ISA, upon which many of the firm's methodologies are built, is more of a principles-based requirement to identify subsequent events that need to be adjusted or need to be disclosed, which is a stronger principle than is in our current standard.
Well, I'd certainly agree with you then, changing the tone of the standard to more of a positive, you need to go search versus just here's 10 things you need to look at. I think that's certainly much more positive and certainly would take it up through the issuance date. As someone receiving financial statements, if the auditor was aware of something before it got filed, I would expect the auditor to go address that or stop the filing. So I think that would be very positive as well. I think some of the issues are not auditing issues. The issue about failure to disclose surprise losses, ITAC has addressed this and written a letter to the FASB on it. You may want to get a copy of that letter. But some of those really revolve more to the, not to the subsequent event type notion, but to the auditing procedures that were done around and surrounding loss contingencies and whether or not the FASB disclosure requirements in that respect are sufficient or not. And, of course, they've had a project ongoing on that seems to have gone one direction, turned around, and gone back to where they started from. So.
And an ED will be coming out very shortly on that one.
Good. Thanks, Lynn. I hope that cleared it up a little bit. Sam?
I never thought I'd say this, but I think I agree with Lynn here. but as long as you don't kiss me on it, I'm okay. I think as I read the paper, I had sort of three observations. One is, is this a burning enough issue? Are there practice issues that need to be rectified? Secondly, to Lynn's point, is this a project that's worth the resources to bump something else on your agenda? And the third point is, and maybe to Marty, to your examples. All bankruptcy filings and all large write-offs occur after some other quarter. So, I mean, I think the other thing that needs to be taken into account is I think AU 560 was probably written at a time when there wasn't the same continuous reporting obligation that exists. So, I mean, as to your question number two, do we need to do more work between the report date and the issuance? Because we're worried there might be 3 or 4 days in there, and that those 3 or 4 days are going to materially change the financials. I have to sort of question whether the cost-benefit really would bear itself out there when, in fact, if something is material, a company's got 4 days to actually get it issued on an 8K, and you know, I think the paper doesn't recognize the continuous disclosure obligation that companies have. So other than that, I probably wouldn't object if you took up the project as long as it was principles based. But otherwise, I'm not sure you got enough here to bump something else off your agenda.
Sam, thanks for those comments. I think your point actually gets to the second part of the question on this is, you know, what would be really the effect on when auditors would date their report and other maybe more practical things that would occur. So, Galen?
Yeah, it would seem to me that, and I agree with both Lynn and Sam, this should be a sort of a principle-based approach. You go out and search, but the auditor needs to know what to search for and what are we actually looking for. While I wouldn't want to see it overly prescriptive, you know, there should be a search part of this, but then it seems to me that you still have kind of your eyes open part of it. you know, what do you become, are you aware of anything? And that would go to maybe this gap that Sam was talking about, this 3-4 days. I mean, is the company going to go to hell in a handbasket in 4 days, you know, in that gap? I doubt it in most situations, but what if you become aware of it, of something that just pops up? So I think you have to, somehow you have to figure out how to, at least on a principle-based notion, cover that gap.
Well, thanks for the input. As we said when we introduced this, this was actually on our agenda and added when FASB was taking on subsequent events to see if we needed to amend our standards. And we're, this input was intended to see should we keep it on our agenda. So I think this we've gotten some good feedback and appreciate the input. Barbara, is that?
No, thanks again for your remarks.
Good. Well, the next subject on our agenda deals with the auditor's report and the auditor's reporting model. We've discussed this. Well, first of all, the auditor's report has probably been discussed forever, and we've heard a lot from users in terms of investors about what their needs are, and they feel that they need more. And so Steve Harris was going to introduce this topic and make some introductory comments. Steve?
Well, Marty, as you mentioned this morning, this session is a follow-up to last April's discussion of what information should be contained in the audit report. And as you also indicated, the content of the auditor's report has been the subject of a long-standing debate over the last century, and with rare exceptions, the issues at hand today are not new. While the conclusions of what should be in the auditor's report have varied over the years, the fundamental issue is clear: whether the current pass-fail nature of the auditor's report is enough. A number of you at April's meeting indicated no, and similarly during the PCAOB's inaugural Investor Advisory Group meeting in May, that same sentiment was expressed by the Investor Advisory Group members. The CEOs of the international audit networks have also in the past recognized the need to address this subject. The issue has been highlighted and raised squarely in the international community as well, as a result of the recent economic crisis by, among others, Michel Barnier, the new Commissioner of Internal Market of the European Commission, Stephen Hadrill, the new CEO of the Financial Reporting Council in the UK, and in a report by the Institute of Chartered Accountants of England and Wales. Stephen Hadrill has asked rather bluntly, do we need to change the audit report to make it more useful, and do we need to see more said in front of the audit report about risk and the business model, and should the auditor provide greater assurance about such matters? The Institute of Chartered Accountants of England and Wales found that the audit report did not provide useful information to users. So this subject is now highly topical not only in the United States but internationally. A cursory look at the voluminous literature describing the pros and cons of what should or should not be in the auditor's report will confirm that this is not an easy topic. Whether some have suggested the report should be expanded to discuss such things as what are the biggest reporting risks, the highest quality description of what is going on, the auditor's responsibility for directing fraud, how the auditor determined materiality, or is supplemented with a separate, more robust report such as the auditor's discussion and analysis, these are just some of the concepts that need to be considered. What is clear, however, is that investors want more. As a follow-up to the April SAG meeting discussion, today the Office of the Chief Auditor will present a potential two-phase project approach. Given the PCAOB's mandate, quote, to protect the interest of investors in the preparation of informative, and I stress informative, accurate, and independent audit reports, close quote, I'm hopeful that we can finally move ahead toward modernizing the audit report to better suit the needs of investors. And now I will turn it over to Bella to introduce and describe the potential approach.
Thank you very much, Steve. At the April SAG meeting, the SAG discussed the ACAP recommendation to, one, clarify in the auditor's report the auditor's role in detecting fraud, and then, two, to consider improvements to the auditor's standard reporting model. There was a lot of good, lively discussion in the breakout groups and then after the next day during the summary session. And two things that kind of came out that the Office of the Chief Auditor heard. One, there was general agreement among the SAG members that there should be more information in the auditor's report to explain the auditor's responsibility around fraud. There was less agreement, however, regarding if and how the current auditor's reporting model, the pass-fail model, could be improved. The SAG discussed that investors and users of the auditor's report need more information from the auditors, but a consensus was not reached as to how best to provide that information and to what extent and how much information needed to be provided to the users and investors. The discussion also focused on whether an addendum to the auditor's report or amending the actual auditor's report would be appropriate and what information would need to be included in either one. Because there was consensus on one aspect of the ACAP recommendation and less agreement on how to proceed on a second aspect of the ACAP recommendation, several SAG members recommended that the staff undertake an immediate project to clarify in the auditor's report the auditor's responsibility around fraud and then conduct additional research and outreach to ascertain additional user needs relating to the form and content of the auditor's report and propose potential solutions. Today, I would like to actually present a possible two-phased approach that the Office of the Chief Auditor has developed to consider changes in the auditor's report and seek the views of the SAG. Phase one is the shorter-term project that encompasses potentially making several specific edits to the auditor's report regarding the auditor's responsibility around fraud. Phase two is a longer-term, multi-year project that will encompass research and outreach to users and others regarding the form and content of the auditor's report. Let me now turn to phase one and provide a more detailed description of what the Office of the Chief Auditor is considering. Phase one includes several items that were discussed with the SAG at the April meeting and for which there seemed to be agreement. At this point in time, the Office of the Chief Auditor is considering recommending to the board the following changes in the auditor's report. Point one, OCA is considering adding the wording, whether caused by error or fraud, to the following statement that's required in the auditor's report currently. The statement is, those standards require that we plan and perform the audit to obtain reasonable assurance about whether the financial statements are free of material misstatements, whether caused by error or fraud. OCA is also considering adding a concept to the auditor's report that explicitly states that reasonable assurance is a high level of assurance, but is not absolute assurance. OCA believes that these two changes will more clearly articulate the auditor's responsibility for detecting material misstatement, whether caused by error or fraud, and also describe to the users the reasonable assurance is a high level of assurance. The next change OCA is considering is recommending to the board is adding an explicit statement to the auditor's report that the auditor is independent as required by applicable rules and regulations. Although there is already a requirement in the board's auditing standards that the title of the auditor's report include the word independent, and obviously there's a requirement that the auditor needs to be independent when conducting their audits, the staff believes it would be informative to users if the auditor made an explicit statement in the auditor's report regarding their independence. The auditor is already required to make this type of communication to the audit committee on an annual basis by the board's Rule 3526, Communications with Audit Committees Concerning Independence, and the staff believes that this will enhance the audit report. The final change the staff is considering as part of phase one is adding a requirement to the audit report to be addressed to both the board of directors and the shareholders. Currently, the auditing standards do not specify to whom the audit report should be addressed to. The audit report is typically addressed to the board of directors or the audit committee of the issuer. The staff believes that investors, as shareholders, have a vested interest in the audit of the issuer, and therefore the staff is considering recommending a requirement for the audit report to be addressed to both the board of directors and the shareholders. At this point, I would actually like to pause and ask a few questions of the SAG regarding their views on whether the potential changes I've just outlined in the auditor's report are appropriate in phase one, and if there are any other changes to the auditor's report that the staff should consider to be addressed in phase one. Jim Cox?
I don't disagree with any of the changes. I will just comment that I'm underwhelmed. I would think that most users believe that the auditor is independent, that there's an independent standard. I would also believe that most people reading the language would understand what assurance means. It's not 100% assurance. You know, I do see the significance on behavior of adding the or fraud language, but I think that that's really at the margins of what else could be done. If you were asking me about how we could really make this communication more important to investors, you know, I would think that whether it be in the formal report or a collateral document or somewhere, even in an SEC filing with, you know, perhaps some necessary safe harbor that would be facilitated by the SEC, I don't know, would be something that the auditor is supposed to be doing anyway and does do, and that is identify to the audit committee and then memorialize that by making it public what the critical accounting choices were, what the critical accounting estimates were, and what the critical assumptions were in the preparation of financial statements as perceived. I think if you did something like that, that would be, well, overwhelming, not underwhelming.
Jim, if I could respond to you, actually, that is something that we'll be looking into under phase two of the project. And that's dealing with the longer-term project of looking at the actual form and content and the additional information that users are looking for and what is the best way to provide that information.
So until that moment, I'll remain underwhelmed.
Hal Schroeder.
I'm going to continue to be underwhelmed as well. Last night at dinner, we had a kind of a similar discussion as to what should go in the auditor's report. And I can recall in my audit days, we prepared something called a summary review memorandum that summarized very much as the good professor was describing, you know, what did we do, why did we do it the way we did it, what were the key results. And to me, that tells you so much more about the company that, you know, all this is window dressing, frankly, at this point. I'm being much more interested in seeing the second phase of the project.
Okay. Lynn Turner?
It would help me, once again, if you could tell me what the time frame is for phase one versus the time frame for phase two, start and finish, and I'll tell you why. A number of years ago, I recall when the FASB called us, a number of us up and said, we're going to work on improving pension accounting. And what do you think of breaking it into phase one and phase two? And a number of us said, well, improving pension accounting is important, so let's go do it, but when are you going to do phase two? And it was, well, after phase one. And to date, they've never done phase two, you know, quite some period of time later. And often phase ones just become an excuse not to do phase two. And so you do the light lifting first, and the regulator or standard setter never get around to phase two. So I think it's difficult unless someone says, okay, when am I going to do phase one? If this is to expedite through a piece of it and get that done relatively quickly, but at the same time you're working on phase two and you know that'll take a little bit longer, then I think that's probably fine. But these days, you know, I'm not that trusting of regulators and standard setters. So my notion is, tell me that in fact you're going to do phase two and tell me what you're going to do in phase two. And that allows me to respond, because if this we'll do phase two when we get down to phase one, then no, I don't believe that works.
Well, Lynn, I think you must have been reading my mind, because actually we're, our recommendation is to actually do both phases at the same time. So now wait for phase one to finish before starting to doing the research and the outreach for phase two. And since there seems to be quite a lot of excitement to see what's actually going to be in phase two and rather than phase one, let me just kind of go through and outline what we have for phase two and then open it up for questions.
And could you also give us some notion of timetable?
There's a slide on the timetable at the end. Basically, okay. Both projects would start in 2010.